Chapter 8. What is a weekend? There are 6 days between Christmas and New Year's, and I have come to hate every one of them. It didn't used to be this way. As a child, I luxuriated in what felt like a much-deserved and much-needed break from school, filled with the afterglow of Christmas, sledding, and cross-country skiing, and devoting hours to reading in bed. Even in college, I'd come home for break, exhausted and usually on the brink of some illness, but reveling in the catharsis of a semester over and done. There was no reading to catch up on, no papers to start organizing. Sometimes I'd babysit for extra cash, or my mom would put me to work on chores around the house. It was long enough off that I eventually got bored with it and craved the return to school and the schedule that accompanied it. In grad school and as a professor, I came to understand that time, like all time formally labeled as a break, was actually just meant for working. But when I started writing for BuzzFeed, the days became a weird, liminal space. About half the office was on vacation, but the half who remained didn't seem to be doing much. Confronted with generalized low work expectations, I don't know what to do with myself. I feel itchy, unsettled, unable to give myself permission to work less, or even not work at all. But it's not just dead week that makes me anxious. For millennials who've internalized the burnout mentality, that more work is always better, and that all time can and should be used to optimize oneself or one's performance, leisure time is often fraught and rarely restful. And that's if we have it in the first place. Leisure numbers are notoriously difficult to track, as they depend on self-reporting, and some male sociologists historically considered childcare to be a form of leisure. But in 2018, adults aged 25 through 34 reported an average of 4.2 hours of leisure a day. 2 of those hours were spent watching television. A bleak 20.4 minutes were dedicated to thinking or relaxing. If, when you think about your own life, those numbers still sound a little high, you're not alone. Those reports are based on the American Time Use Diaries, which ask participants to faithfully categorize the events of each day. But the quantity of leisure ultimately matters far less than its quality. Is texting your mom leisure? Is going to the gym to put in 35 minutes on the elliptical trainer? Is mindless scrolling on Instagram or trying to read the latest political news in bed or supervising your kids at the park? Part of our problem is that we work more. But the other problem is that the hours when we're not technically working never feel free from optimization, either of the body, the mind, or one's social status. The word leisure comes from the Latin licere, variously translated as to be permitted or to be free. Leisure, then, is time you are allowed to do what you'd like, free from the compunction to generate value. But when all hours can be theoretically converted to more work, the hours when you're not working feel like a lost opportunity or just an abject failure. I'm the most unleisured person I know, Caroline, a white writer and podcaster in her 30s, told me. The combination of her first work experiences in the post-recession economy and her place in the freelance market, where you can always be doing more, have made her that way. I've never had a hobby that I didn't monetize, whether I meant to or not, she told me. She travels ostensibly on vacation and finds herself returning again and again to her work. For Caroline, every task has to feel like it's clearly moving her life forward. Doing errands is okay because it's part of the work of organizing her home and life. So is tweeting and Instagramming because it contributes to her overall brand, which keeps her employed. I don't even think I'm financially motivated so much as motivated by the fear that I don't have the tools or talent to carry me through the rest of my life, she explained. Doctors can always be doctors. Lawyers can always be lawyers. But I've made a living as part of this creative class, and I don't know what that looks like in 15, 30, 50 years. Every chance, every book deal, every podcast could be your last. The thing is, I found a lot of success in this hustle, she said. And knowing that this mentality has paid off in big dividends further reinforces the behavior. She reads about cultivating rest and doing nothing and thinks that's fine for other people. But if she tries to relax, hang out, read a book at the pool, it has serious ramifications on her mental health. At this point, Caroline fears she's been working this way for so long that her attitude is too broken to ever be fixed. That's a word I heard over and over again as millennials told me about their relationship to leisure. It's broken. Historically, leisure was the time to do what you will. The 8 hours of the day not spent on working or resting. People cultivated hobbies, anything from walking aimlessly to constructing model airplanes. What mattered is that it wasn't done to make yourself a more desirable match, to declare your societal status, or make some extra money on the side. It was done for pleasure, which is again why it's so ironic that millennials, stereotyped as the most self-absorbed generation, have lost sight of what doing something simply for personal pleasure looks like. Our leisure rarely feels restorative or self-guided or even fun. Hanging out with friends, exhausting to coordinate. Dating, an online slog. A dinner party, way too much work. I'm unclear whether I spend my Saturday mornings on long runs because I like it or because it's a productive way to discipline my body. Do I read fiction because I love to read fiction or to say that I have read fiction? These aren't entirely new phenomena, but they help explain the prevalence of millennial burnout. It's hard to recover from days spent laboring when your time off feels like work. 200 years ago, formal leisure was the provenance of the aristocracy. You went to university not because you needed a good degree on your CV, but because you wanted to join the clergy or liked books. And what else would you do with your days? Maybe go on a walk, call on a friend, or learn an instrument, or play cards, or embroider. But none of those things was done to make money. You had well enough of it, and everyone knew as much, because you spent your days wholly engaged in leisure. Most non-aristocrats had only the briefest swatches of leisure, for religious services and holidays and harvest celebrations. The rhythms of work, on the farm, in the kitchen, were the rhythms of life. It wasn't until the first Industrial Revolution and the mass movement of workers into the city and into the factory that the first labor reformers called for the creation of a 5-day week. Leisure was, in many important ways, democratized, especially for those in the cities, who flocked to the bevy of so-called cheap amusements, amusement parks, movie theaters, dance halls, that popped up to serve them. In 1926, increased mechanization and automation and resultant productivity meant that Henry Ford could announce a 5-day work week. In 1930, the British economist John Maynard Keynes predicted that his grandchildren would work only 15 hours a week. With abundant time for leisure across the classes, society would flourish. Democratic participation would go up, reformers argued, as would societal cohesion, familial bonds, philanthropic and volunteer work. People would have the time and space to engage with ideas and seek out new ones, to delight in friends and family, to experiment with new skills simply because they please us. These things had been the provenance of the rich, or at least the very rich man, for some time. But soon, theoretically, they would be available for all. Today, that vision sounds utopian, or at the very least, fantastical. In Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream, Benjamin Honeycutt points out that as productivity continued to increase and unions began to successfully advocate for decreased work hours, public and private society embarked on a massive expansion of the infrastructure of leisure. They built camps and vacation resorts. They started community sports leagues and launched a vigorous parks and recreation movement, including the development of thousands of public park spaces we enjoy today. These spaces weren't built so we could sit in them while hunched over a sandwich from Pret a Manger and respond to emails on our phone, but in anticipation of mass leisure. But something curious happened on the path to the 15-hour work week. At first, as productivity went up, the number of expected hours at work did indeed decrease. But starting in the 1970s, they began to rise again. Part of the reason was classic American capitalism. If you can make 100 widgets in less time, that doesn't mean everyone should work less. Instead, they should work the same number of hours and make more widgets. But part of it, too, had to do with the rise of a different sort of work, knowledge work, with a different sort of widget. Knowledge workers have outcomes and products, but unlike a factory product, they were difficult to measure. As a result, these workers are salaried, as in paid for the entire year instead of by the hour. During the Great Compression era, most salaried workers still worked a 40-hour work week, but without the rigidity of clocking in or out, and depending on your contract, a legal demand to pay overtime. You might assume that most salaried workers would never exceed 40 hours, or maybe even straight up waste some of those 40 hours. And at least for part of the 20th century, that was the case. Think of the storied boozy lunch, the Mad Men-style in-office liquor carts, the couch naps. After all, most of these salaried men, and they were almost always men, had secretaries to do everything save the most essential components of their jobs. Up until the 1970s, the middle-class male, whether in the factory or in the office, still had hours of delineated leisure time to enjoy outside of work. But as the economy began to falter, the number of hours spent at work continued to increase. With massive downsizing and layoffs across the business sector, every worker had to prove their worth, both to their supervisors, but also to consultants sent in to identify redundancies and inefficiencies. And the easiest way to signal that you were working harder and were more essential to the company than the person sitting next to you was to work longer. At the same time, payment and hourly jobs ceased to keep pace with inflation, and many hourly workers clamored for overtime pay or a second job to cover household expenses in the same manner as before. One of the easiest ways for a company to reduce its bottom line was to drastically cut benefits. But benefit cuts hurt company morale. So instead, they hired fewer people and thus paid out fewer benefits and simply expected them to do more work. Even as actual productivity continued to rise year after year, companies continued to reduce paid time off. In an attitude that should sound familiar today, in a tight job market, workers had little choice but to agree to the increased hours and demands. In her landmark book, The Overworked American, Juliet B. Shore found what, at the time of the book's publication in 1990, felt almost scandalous. Since 1970, there had been a steady, year-after-year increase in the amount of work Americans performed, and a dramatic decrease in average leisure time, down to just 16.5 hours a week. Shore wasn't the first to ring the alarm. In 1988, the New York Times attempted to explain why all those people feel they never have any time. Time published a cover story declaring America has run out of time the next year. It's no coincidence workaholism became a broad cultural anxiety around this period. What had been perceived as hard work for more than a decade was suddenly recognized for the strangeness that it was. But that was the strangeness that reared us, that millennials observed in our parents, even if it wasn't called workaholism, and that we would internalize as we went through school toward college. Sure, no one liked working all the time, but that didn't make it seem any less necessary. Today, the workaholism first diagnosed amongst boomers has become so commonplace as to no longer even be considered a pathology. Whether you're putting in 60 hours a week at your salaried job or cobbling together 37 at Walmart plus 13 driving Uber, it's just the way it is. There are countless other ways that work seeps into our best attempts at leisure time. Today's work crises always seem to demand immediate attention, even when nothing about them or their ramifications would change if you just waited to handle them in the morning. The continued globalization of work means that you might be needed on a conference call at 3 p.m. in Berlin or 6 a.m. in Portland. A manager who is too frazzled during the day to keep up with her email attends to it in bed at 10 p.m. Her responses compel people to respond by 10:15 p.m. Some office cultures demand self-sacrificing presentism. Last one out of the office wins. But for most millennials I know, the only person forcing them to work long hours is themselves. Not because we're masochists, but because we've internalized the idea that the only way to keep excelling at our jobs is to work all the time. The problem with this attitude is that working all the time doesn't mean producing all the time, but it nonetheless creates a self-satisfying fiction of productivity. That ceaseless drive for productivity isn't a natural human force, and at least in its current form, is a relatively recent phenomenon. In Counterproductive, Time Management in the Knowledge Economy, the Intel engineer Melissa Gregg examines the history of the productivity craze, which she dates to the 1970s, with subsequent spikes in the 1990s and the present. Gregg connects each wave of productivity management guides, self-help books, and today, apps, to periods of anxiety over downsizing and the perceived need to prove oneself as more productive, and as such, more theoretically valuable, than one's peers. Amidst our current climate of economic precarity, the only way to create and maintain a semblance of order is to adhere to the gospel of productivity, whether blasting through your email to get to inbox zero or ignoring it altogether. A variety of lucrative businesses have emerged to facilitate peak productivity. Catering to a mix of those desperate to pack even more work into their day and others whose workload makes them feel like they're drowning in the most basic adult responsibilities. As Anna Wiener makes clear in Uncanny Valley, so many of the innovations of Silicon Valley of the last decade were designed to speak to the affluent and the overextended, selling everything from toothbrushes to vitamins directly through our Instagram accounts. On any given night in America, exhausted parents and New Year's Eve resolution cooks were unpacking identical cardboard boxes shipped by meal prep startups, disposing of identical piles of plastic packaging, and sitting down to identical dishes, she writes. Homogeneity was a small price to pay for the erasure of decision fatigue. It liberated our minds to pursue other endeavors, like work. One result of this drive for productivity is a new hierarchy of labor. On the top end, there are salaried, hyper-productive knowledge workers. Below, there are the people who perform the mundane tasks that make that productivity possible. Nannies, task rabbits, Uber Eats drivers, house cleaners, personal organizers, trunk club stylists, blue apron packagers, Amazon warehouse workers and drivers, Fresh Direct shoppers. Rich people have always had servants. The difference, then, is that those servants made it so that they didn't have to work, not so that they could work more. The people who facilitate these productivity-facilitating tasks, however, are almost always independent contractors, underpaid, with little job security or recourse from mistreatment. Many are driven by their own set of unrealistic productivity standards. But instead of getting paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to grind themselves into the ground to meet them, they're barely making minimum wage. In the modern workplace, it seems like everyone in the salaried workplace, from managers to workers themselves, is so anxious about proving their value that we neglect a veritable cornucopia of evidence that better work is almost always achieved through less work. The head of a very staid New Zealand trust company read about a study that found that office workers, working a standard 40-hour week, were only productive for between 1.5 and 2.5 hours every day. So he decided to try something revolutionary. Institute a 4-day work week wherein every employee would be paid the same so long as they continue to reach their previous productivity goals, just in 80% of the time. At the end of a 2-month-long trial, they found that productivity had risen 20%, while work-life balance satisfaction scores rose from 54% to 78%. In 2019, a similar trial at Microsoft Japan resulted in a 40% rise in productivity. Rest doesn't just make workers happier, but makes them more efficient when they're actually on the job. To admit as much, though, means confronting ossified American ideologies about work. That more work is good and less work is bad, no matter how much evidence suggests otherwise. Which is why opting out of work, at least in our current situation, doesn't feel possible. Earlier this year, a friend took a day off for a much-needed weekend away from her job as a lawyer at a startup. She told him that she could be reached, in case of emergency, on her cell. Hours later, the phone lit up. It wasn't an emergency, but her boss sure could use her input. The same scenario applies across the workforce. Flight attendants, service workers, janitorial staff, all can be called, even if it's their day off, and compelled to come back into work. Each of us has become, in our individual ways, essential. That's why my friend received that call. She was the only person who could answer her boss's question. But that's also why people feel guilty for taking time off. Someone has to do their work. So it'll either be them drowning in a fire hose of accumulated work when they return, or their coworkers simmering in resentment when they have to pull a double shift. In our current setup, any attempt to draw clear lines around work and leisure or to deal with one's own burnout means creating burnout in others. What feels like the only solution is also the least useful one. We just keep working more. Instead of shaping business around our own bodily rhythms, we bend, blunt, and otherwise ignore our body's demands in order to work at all times. The theorist Jonathan Crary situates this work seepage as part of a mentality of 24/7, in which one's personal and social identity has been reorganized to conform to the uninterrupted operation of markets, information networks, and other systems. Some of us work these body and mind-breaking hours because we must. Others simply work them because we can. Granted, before the Industrial Revolution, many people's jobs as farmers or doctors or wet nurses would periodically require working into the night and even on holy days. It wasn't until the Second Industrial Revolution, however, and the demand to operate factories at full capacity around the clock that every hour became a workable hour. But even as the day, swing, and night shifts became regular features of factory life across America, blue laws banning the operation of most types of business on Sundays helped preserve at least one day of rest. Many of the laws specifically applied to the sale of alcohol, an extension of moralizing Christian forces who wanted to preserve the Sabbath from some debauched fate, which is part of why such laws have been challenged. Why should those who are non-religious adhere to a religious day? But the courts have repeatedly evoked the secular benefits of a workless Sunday. Upon no subject is there such a concurrence of opinion among philosophers, moralists, and statesmen of all nations as on the necessity of periodical cessation from labor, Chief Justice Stephen Johnson Field of the California Supreme Court wrote in 1858. One day in seven is the rule, founded in experience and sustained by science. Philosophers, moralists, and statesmen still agree that rest would be nice, but it's repeatedly rejected as necessary. The blue laws that persist today are mostly regarded as an annoyance. Most mid to large-sized businesses, save those owned by the most pious, remain open on Sunday. In the Sabbath world, Judith Shulevitz suggests that the process began with the gradual commercialization of leisure in the 20th century. Before, Sundays were largely spent in and around the home and church. People ate at home or with their family members, using food items purchased earlier in the week. For the pious, time was spent in meditation or devotion. For the less so, spare hours could be used for reading or playing or other forms of diversion. But then people began seeking out structured activities that cost money on the weekend, which in turn required others to work, whether in the form of the person checking tickets at the movie theater or the person selling concessions. And when enough of those people start working, even more people are enlisted to tap the market, from convenience store employees to grocery stockers. The need for public services increases as well. You need an employee to unlock the bathrooms at the park, and many more to drive buses and subways. The desire for services becomes the normalization of services. Today, 31% of full-time employees and 56% of people with multiple jobs work on the weekends. Only a handful of government holidays, 4th of July, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, feel observed in a meaningful way. And even then, many retail service employees still work. During the Christmas season, even mail carriers have begun to work Sundays. Not because we need our Christmas presents any faster, but because the United States Postal Service sees it as a possible way to compete with its private competitors. And while the class secure or union protected can still refuse to work on certain days or at certain times, those without leverage, particularly the undocumented, the undereducated, or those working multiple jobs, mangle the rhythms of their lives to correspond with the demands of capital. The ever-broadening class divide isn't just between the haves and the have-nots, or the productive and those facilitating their productiveness, but those who can protect a modicum of hours devoted to sleep and those who cannot. Work hasn't colonized our weekends and holidays because we simply can't get enough of it. Before, the logic of capitalism had been legally cordoned off from Sundays. Now it's been let loose on all of our leisure time, and our attitudes about what that time's potential is have changed accordingly. Leisure scholars point to economist Staffan B. Linder's The Harried Leisure Class, published in 1970, as the first text to identify the consequences of a market seeking ever more growth, ever larger markets, and ever more consumption to fuel them. Within that model, every hour of every day becomes increasingly valuable to a company, but also to oneself. In this way, any time spent not working, that is, leisure time, is money that's effectively lost. In order to reconcile ourselves to that idea, we cram as many activities and as much consumption as possible into our leisure time so as to make it valuable in some way. To evoke this style of manic consumption, Linder describes a man who, after dinner, fills his leisure by drinking Brazilian coffee, sipping a French cognac, reading the New York Times, listening to a Brandenburg concerto, and his Swedish wife all at the same time, with varying degrees of success. Today's version might be the woman who drinks her $7 cold brew with a $4 coconut water in her purse, on her way to yoga, while listening to The Daily on her headphones, while sending appropriate reaction gifts to her group text about their upcoming girls' weekend. The strategy of maximizing what leisure we do have, for ourselves, for our families, with our peers, has everything to do with, big surprise, class anxiety. In The Sum of Small Things, A Theory of the Aspirational Class, Elizabeth Currid Halkett argues that a subsection of Americans have become increasingly concerned with expressing their class position through cultural signifiers that convey their acquisition of knowledge and value system. In other words, talking about, Instagramming, and otherwise broadcasting engagement with the sort of leisure activities, media products, and purchases that underline elite status. You are what you eat, read, watch, and wear, but it doesn't end there. You're also the gym you belong to, the filters you use to post vacation photos, where you go on that vacation. It's not enough to listen to NPR, read the latest nonfiction National Book Award winner, or run a half marathon. You have to make sure others know you are the type of person who makes that particular sort of productive, self-edifying, optimized use of your leisure time. And while many of the products and experiences associated with the aspirational class are fairly old-school middle brow, reading best-selling literary fiction, watching Oscar-bait movies, the current mark of the cultured bourgeois is a taste for the highbrow and lowbrow, the ballet and the best dancers on TikTok, the best of prestige television and the plot turns of the entire Real Housewives franchise. To be cultured is to be culturally omnivorous, no matter how much time it takes. When people complain about too much television, this is part of what they're complaining about. Not that there's an abundance of options for all manner of tastes available in the marketplace, but that the amount of consumption necessary to keep up in conversation just keeps growing. Episodes, podcasts, even sporting events come to feel like checklists. It doesn't matter if you actually like any of these things or even actually consume them in entirety, so much as signal on social media and in person that you are the type of person who consumes them. And when you only have so much time to dedicate to leisure, there's a constant demand to make the very best use of your time, consuming the products and engaging in leisure that most effectively demonstrates your status as a cultural omnivore. You open, and then aspirationally save for later, dozens of articles recommended by others. You buy some yarn and a how-to-knit book and never cast a stitch. You start a book and then wonder if you should be reading the other, cooler book. You dabble, and then you look over your shoulder or scroll through Instagram for something better. As Currid Halkett points out, this practice transcends actual income levels. Adjunct professors with PhDs barely making ends meet often consume and broadcast the same aspirational class materials as Ivy League-educated lawyers. It obscures the sort of economic stability a degree can actually provide, but provides a different sort of class salve. It's okay if you're hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, will never buy a home, and are terrified of what a medical catastrophe could bring, so long as you can still blend in with higher incomes in a social setting. In a profile of Michael Barbaro, the host of The Daily, the massively popular New York Times podcast, and a perfect example of aspirational consumption, producer Jenna Weiss-Berman pinpoints the show's appeal. "You listen to The Daily and you're better equipped to speak at a dinner party," she explained. "And that's all you really want." We love to think that our cultural and leisure tastes are, to some extent, natural. I sign up for this triathlon, I watch this show, I download this podcast because I like it. But every choice is muddled by our understanding of what it says about us and the conversations from which we'll be excluded if we opt out. It's okay to skip one TV show or franchise or trend, but opt out entirely and you'll be out of the loop the next time you hang out with your similarly class aspirational friends. It's not enough just to hang out, after all. There has to be a purpose. The popularity of the book club isn't just about people reading more. It's also about needing a productive affixation to the simple desire to be with other people. A similar dynamic happens with travel and exercise. If you don't have enough money to plan a trip to Japan, you can still talk about the best new Japanese restaurant in town. If you can't afford SoulCycle or a road bike, you can still talk about training for your weekly Saturday long run. If you can't donate to a political campaign, you can still authoritatively talk about a candidate's strategy after listening to Pod Save America, which is one of the reasons that newsletters like The Skim, which currently boasts more than 7 million subscribers and was last valued at upwards of 55 million, have become so popular. They're a cheat sheet for aspirational consumption, offering bite-sized briefings on every topic that could come up at drinks after work. They make it easier, as The Skim tagline declares, to live smarter, or at least to appear as if you are. Is watching movies, going to yoga, and listening to podcasts work? Of course not, not technically. A whole lot of people would love to feel pressure to watch more television instead of being forced to spend those hours on the job. But when this type of cultural consumption becomes the only way to buy a ticket into your aspirational class, it feels less like a choice and more of an obligation, a form of unpaid labor. Which explains why relaxing by engaging in these activities can feel so exhausting, so unfulfilling, so frustratingly unrestorative. Cramming your leisure with aspirational class value might quell some anxieties about class security. But an even more effective way to feel secure in one's class is to make more money, specifically by monetizing your hobby. A hobby is technically an activity performed during leisure time for the sheer purpose of pleasure. If you try an activity once, you're a dabbler. Somewhere in the process of doing it again and again and again, it becomes a hobby. Many of today's hobbies involve cultivating skills that machines have made obsolete, or at least technically unnecessary. Knitting, baking, tinkering. Others provide the pleasure of collecting and categorizing, or incredible concentration and attention to detail. Or harmony, literal and figurative, with others. Singing in a choir, that's a hobby. So is a bowling league, a quilting circle, a running club. A video game can definitely be a hobby, especially community building, strategy refining games like Minecraft or The Sims. Some hobbies, especially ones involving exercise, double as a means to build aspirational capital. In most places in the country, being a person who downhill skis is to underline that you have the means to outfit yourself and pay for a $100 lift ticket. But many hobbies, especially ones related to craft, feel like throwbacks. Cool only in so much as they're proudly uncool. Sometimes we pick them up as adults, but many hobbies start when we're kids, passed down from family and community. I hike and camp because my dad hikes and camps. I garden because my mom gardens. She gardens because her mom gardened. Hobbies are evacuated of ambition. Any purpose is secondary. They're pleasure for pleasure's sake. But when your entire life has been geared toward building value for college, hobbies feel like foreign, almost obscene dreams. Every activity must be a means to an end. Growing up, my partner only read books for class, only sang when in choirs that would look good on his resume, only participated in rowing because the best colleges wanted a sport. It wasn't until he hit his 30s and we moved to Montana that he finally found the space to try to figure out what he actually liked doing instead of what he should do to add value to himself. Today, he describes the process as fraught with guilt and self-doubt. For many millennials, there's a drive to make anything you dedicate yourself to as perfect as possible. I can't be a mediocre cyclist or dancer or hiker, Allie, a white woman on the trajectory toward upper middle class, told me. I have to be balls to the walls amazing at it. Laura, who identifies as Jewish and middle class, remembers a time in her 20s when she had hobbies. I sang in bands, I learned guitar, and started to learn drums, she recalls. But then I got into graduate school and figured I wouldn't have the time or resources to keep it up. I felt guilty devoting time to something that wasn't furthering my writing career. Recently, she got her drum set from back at home, but still struggles to find the time she'd like to devote to it. I don't like to do anything half-assed, she said. But of course, that would require a lot more leisure time than I have. Some of the people who have most time for leisure and feel the least pressure to monetize their hobbies are those with what some might call the most boring jobs. Ethan, who's white and currently lives in Nashville, works as a claims processor for a major insurance company. He works exactly 40 hours a week and considers himself lower middle class. There's a clear delineation between when he's working and when he's not, and that allows him to protect his leisure hours, which he largely devotes to playing and writing about Dungeons & Dragons. When people do find the time and mental space to cultivate a hobby, especially if you're good at it, then pressure to monetize it begins to accumulate. If someone loves to bake and starts bringing her creations to parties, the only way we know how to really compliment them is to suggest, you could do this for money. Janique, who's 31, Black, and middle class, prides herself on maintaining time for singing and songwriting. But since she's joined a band, the pressure from others to get paid for it in some way has ramped up considerably. Gina, who identifies as Asian American and middle class, knows that the idea that you should make money from the things that give you pleasure is societal. I've learned a lot about the exploitation that kind of mindset allows, she told me. And I don't want the pure love I have for my hobbies to be polluted by the false promise that I might be able to make some bucks from my efforts. I've seen my friends try to monetize, and I have seen my friends succeed at monetizing. I have seen my friends grow to hate or feel shackled by what once brought them joy. No thank you. In today's economy, though, it's often a privilege to protect one's hobby from monetization. Jimmy, who lives in southern Wisconsin and describes his class position as not homeless anymore and owns a home, works 80 to 100 hours a week patching together gigs in broadcasting, social media, digital content creation, and design. I've monetized almost every aspect of my life that isn't being a parent, and I'm a couple medical bills away from starting a dad blog, he explained. I even broadcast my video game tournaments. He'd love to keep things to himself, but he has two kids to support. We need money, and I don't have time to waste being unproductive, he told me. It's not as fun, but we have a roof over our heads. Jimmy estimates that he has around 5 to 7 hours of leisure time a week, his commute, and then the half hour he spends passed out on the couch when he comes home from work. He doesn't even consider broadcasting a video game tournament leisure, or even a hobby. When he monetized it, he changed the very nature of the activity. A monetized hobby might be periodically enjoyable, but when the activity becomes a means to an end, whether profit or perfection or entrance into school, it loses its essential and essentially restorative quality. I found that people who do have hobbies and find solace in them are the ones who've given themselves the broadest permission for failure and imperfection. They revel in the process of making a table rather than feel pressure to sell it once it's finished. Or they just enjoy the experience of a hike rather than the Instagram of their view at the top and the fetishization of being the sort of person who hikes. They understand that reading a book matters not because others know about it, but because you took pleasure in it. That attitude might sound simple or just obvious, but for so many millennials, it often feels impossible. Millennials have stopped going to religious services in massive numbers. We stream Netflix at home instead of going to the movies. The country club, the Elks Club, the volunteer fire department, the unpaid governmental committees that make local government run, all are struggling. We go on Tinder dates instead of simply showing up at the bar. We group text instead of hanging out with our friend group, because finding a time when everyone's schedules align means planning 4 months in advance. Back in 2000, the book Bowling Alone, written by the political scientist Robert Putnam, argued that American participation in groups, clubs, and organizations, religious, cultural, or otherwise, had precipitously dropped, as had the social cohesion that sprang from regular participation in them. Putnam's findings were controversial and contested, and many argued that community had simply shifted locations. Maybe no one was going to bowling league, but they were hanging out online, in AOL chat rooms, on message boards, instead. 20 years later, and our burnout levels, like our political and cultural polarization, speak to the prescience of Putnam's findings. Following publication of Bowling Alone, several of Putnam's critics embarked on their own research, looking to either counter or confirm Putnam's claims. In 2011, they found significant decreases in both familial and non-familial networks, but non-familial most of all. American social networks are collapsing inward, Putnam wrote in his 2015 follow-up, Our Kids, and now consist of fewer, denser, more homogenous, more familiar, and less non-kin ties. But why aren't we hanging out with other people? Part of the problem is that the ability to easily coordinate schedules disintegrated alongside standardized working hours. If your schedule shifts from week to week, either due to algorithmic recalculation or your own inclination to stretch work hours, it can feel impossible to make plans or weekly commitments. Add in the increased pressure to arrange and supervise children's activities, and your available hours become even more difficult to overlap with others. No one wants to admit just how difficult it will be to actually make plans happen. So people declare their best intentions to meet up for a drink, for a playdate, for dinner, and then cycle into an endless cycle of that doesn't work for me, could we do next week? And last minute cancellations. In Palaces for the People, Eric Kleinenberg suggests that part of the decline in social ties is rooted in our preference for efficiency. He points to a study that found that a daycare that made pickup as seamless and quick as possible meant that parents hardly got to know each other. But when you force the parents to come inside, wait around, and pick up their kids at the same time, boom, social connections began to form. But part of the problem, too, is a decline in social infrastructure. The spaces, public and private, from libraries to supper clubs and synagogues, that made it easy to cultivate informal, non-monetary ties. These places still exist, of course, but they have become less central and less vital, and most importantly, less accessible. Because of liability issues, more and more churches are limiting the ability of members to use the space off hours, even if they pay for it. Many public beaches and parks charge exclusionary fees for parking and entrance, and areas without public transportation. Public playing fields and tracks are now locked or monopolized by teams that have paid to practice. A woman in upstate New York tried to convene a book club of people with similar interests she'd met on the internet. She didn't want to host it in her home and spent weeks trying to find a space that was accessible and affordable to everyone. "We used to enjoy seeing AAA baseball downtown," one parent told me. Then they turned the family zone, open grassy berms where kids liked to play, into pay group party areas. Then they moved into a new stadium on the rich side of town. Then we stopped going. A woman in the D.C. area told me that the Wegmans grocery store in an upper-middle-class, predominantly Black neighborhood had a small area in the front room to drink coffee and eat. People often use that area for church meetings, board games, and study groups, she said. There are now signs discouraging that. Teresa, a postdoctoral researcher in Boston, consciously chose to join a gaming group because there was a set meeting time every week, always in the same place. "Otherwise, my friends and I only play like once a month," she said, "because it just takes so much effort to find a time and place that works." That's what social infrastructure helps provide, a relief from endless planning and replanning. The Lions, Eagles, Moose, or Elks Club meetings were like clockwork, and in a space with parking that was always available. Same with church and Bible study, PEO in the Junior League, the NAACP and League of Women's Voters. Their reliability was part of what made them easier to engage in. But as work and parenting expectations continued to expand and priorities continued to shift inward, group commitments were one of the easiest time-consuming activities to jettison. As fewer and fewer people attended, the groups themselves began to disappear, with little to replace them, at least little that's affordable, that has regular meetings, that isn't religiously specific, or doesn't center on children. We can talk about the value of group sports all we want, but attending a child's soccer game and spending most of your time on the sidelines attending to work email is not the same as playing on a team yourself. I'm not the first person to tell you any of this. Most of us have read all about the studies that show that volunteering makes you happier, that in-person conversation and laughter is more nourishing than digital communication, that time for contemplation, religious or otherwise, makes us feel more balanced and less anxious. We know that leisure, especially the sort that Putnam describes as foundational to social ties, makes us feel better. But for many people, just the idea of any of those activities seems to require an insurmountable expenditure of energy. In short, we're too tired to actually rest and restore ourselves. Megan, who's white and lives in Albany, works a full-time job as an administrative assistant and a part-time job as a bookseller. She finds an hour or so a day plus one day on the weekend for leisure time. But she increasingly finds personal interactions, and dating especially, to be emotionally daunting and draining. Even hanging out with her best friend wipes her out. Rosie, a literary agent in New York, cannot extract leisure activities from their costs. Lying in bed scrolling Twitter is free, she points out. And living in New York just requires more energy, both physical, walking everywhere, and mental, researching service changes to the subway and buses. Plus, she says, if I don't get a good Instagram post of the leisure activity, I might as well not have done it. Laura, who lives in Chicago and works as a special ed teacher, never wants to see her friends or date or cook. She's so tired, she just wants to melt into the couch. But then I can't focus on what I'm watching and end up unfocused again and not completely relaxing, she explained. Here I am telling you I don't even relax right. I feel bad about feeling bad. But by the time I have leisure time, I just want to be alone. And the pressure seems to build even more with kids. Claire, age 29, lives with her husband and two children in eastern Pennsylvania. Her husband works two jobs in an office and as a freelance writer, while she works part-time, 12 to 16 hours a week, and stays home to take care of her kids. She's also learning a new trade on the side, computer networking, since her current job has no room for advancement. She gets out of the house every few weeks with friends, but there have been periods when she didn't see friends for months at a time. It was simply too hard to coordinate. Once, maybe twice a month, she and her husband find a sitter to go out. I have to really push myself and plan ahead if I want to attend a meetup or event, because the shockwaves it sends through my routine are so hard to absorb, she admitted. Way too often, I cancel at the last minute because I'm worn out from the day. It's important to pause with that scenario, one that I've heard over and over and that I've articulated myself. Being with our friends, the people who love and cherish us, is too unsettling to our schedules. But our schedules are our lives. And what are our lives without others? We watch television, we smoke more weed and drink to force our bodies to relax. We elevate and celebrate introvert behavior with t-shirts that read, "Sorry I'm late, I'd rather be at home." We try to feel okay with the way things are. But what haunts me is the truth that what you do with your leisure time now, when it's so rare and so overdetermined and so overladen with exhaustion, is not, at least not necessarily, what you would do if you had more of it. So many of our best intentions, our most curious and creative and compassionate selves, are right there, closer beneath the surface of our lives than we know. We simply need space, time, and rest to make them a reality. Sometimes I purposefully pick the longest line at the grocery store and watch myself react to my impatience, my inability to hang out, even for just a handful of extra minutes, with my own mind. I'm addicted to stimulation. I've forgotten not just how to wait, but even how to let my mind wander and play. And how to do nothing, resisting the attention economy, Jenny Odell makes a deeply compelling case for ignoring all of the impulses toward productivity and perfection that have come to imbue our lives, leisure, and otherwise. That means doing, well, nothing. At least nothing that is conceived of as value-making under capitalism. Odell describes the deep pleasures of learning the names of the flora and fauna in her local park. Learning their names means being able to actually notice them, see them, and spend time recognizing them, simply because they occupy the same space as us. They matter and are valuable simply because they are, not because they make us better workers or more desirable partners or more economically secure. There are all sorts of ways to do nothing. And they don't necessarily even involve sequestering ourselves from the internet or purposefully choosing the longest line at the grocery store. Caring for others, worshiping, singing, and talking, and hanging out with your own mind, all of it can be blissfully, radically unproductive. It matters because it nourishes you and others. Full stop. Odell argues that we've come to the point where we downplay all of the competing forces for our attention, using words like annoying or distracting to describe the engineered addiction of social media, the fear of missing an important email, the compulsion to render leisure in some way financially and personally productive. But distractions, Odell writes, keep us from doing the things we want to do, which then accumulate and keep us from living the lives we want to live. In this way, the best, most alive parts of ourselves are paved over by a ruthless logic of use. A reckoning with burnout is so often a reckoning with the fact that the things you fill your day with, the things you fill your life with, feel unrecognizable from the sort of life you want to live and the sort of meaning you want to make of it. That's why the burnout condition is more than just addiction to work. It's an alienation from the self and from desire. If you subtract your ability to work, who are you? Is there a self left to excavate? Do you know what you like and don't like when there's no one there to watch? And no exhaustion to force you to choose the path of least resistance? Do you know how to move without always moving forward? A recommitment to and cherishing of oneself isn't self-care or self-centeredness, at least not in the contemporary connotations of those words. Instead, it's a declaration of value. Not because you labor, not because you consume, not because you produce, but simply because you are. To emerge from burnout and ultimately resist its return is to remember as much.